Welcome to Coaching Uncaged, the podcast that pushes the boundaries of the coaching profession with cutting-edge practitioners, authors, and thought leaders. Coaching Uncaged brings you pioneering thinking to enrich the art and science of coaching in all its forms. And now, introducing your host, Robert Stevenson.
Welcome to the podcast. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Nick Thorpe, an author, a trainer, a supervisor, a workshop leader, and so much more beyond the labels that I've just given you, Nick. Welcome to the podcast.
No, you're too kind, Robert. It's good to be back again.
It's great to see you. I always sort of have these moments of trying to remember when I last saw or spoke to somebody, but I have this real defining memory of yourself and Emma Dempsey sat in Emma's flat talking about training and delivery up in Edinburgh for a whole day, I think we spent talking about delivery.
Yeah, that feels like a world ago, doesn't it? Back in the days we actually met face to face and did things like walked on beaches and stuff.
So we're talking today a little bit about your work around Coaching the Shadow. It's part of one of the masterclasses that you're delivering for us here at Animus. But before we sort of delve into that, it would be great to just sort of, for people that don't know you, just to hear a little bit about sort of who you are, your background, and maybe even a little bit about what led you to coaching and coach training.
Sure, yeah. I've got a slightly unusual background for a coach, and I started off as a journalist years ago, which I guess is, you know, all about narrative as well. And I guess it was all about asking questions as well. I obviously started off asking a particular kind of question to get a particular kind of response as a news reporter, and then quickly felt they were quite circular questions, you know, trying to generate conflict. I worked on the Scotsman and the Edinburgh Evening News and then various London broadsheets. And, you know, whenever it was newsy, it felt like we were kind of trying to get a particular response or trying to generate conflict. And I enjoyed going into feature writing much more and getting under the skin of and sort of what made people tick, why we're here. The questions kind of got bigger as I went on. And then I got into travel writing and just got more and more philosophical and more and more aware of my own stuff that I needed to work on as well. So I had this big sort of societal shadow, if you like, out there of what, you know, all the stuff going on in the world that journalists report on, but also my own sense of kind of often stuckness or like what's going on for me, why am I here, and so that kind of went hand in hand with my traveling. I sort of went on an inner journey as well, and that led to coaching eventually. Not quite that straightforward, but that's the cut to the chase version.
And you just said about going on that inner journey whilst you were also doing the outer journey of travel writing, which sort of made me think of the hero's journey. And I know you've done some work around that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, wherever you go in the world, people are kind of grappling with the same stuff. You know, there's the survival level stuff in sort of poorer parts of the world, I guess. And, you know, we learn then that actually, even when you've got that stuff, happiness doesn't come that easily to us. We get into kind of conflicts with others, but also with ourselves. And by about 40, I was really in a kind of quite midlife place of just feeling very stuck, I guess. And also about sort of being male, I guess I felt that men were kind of the problem mostly in the world. I had certainly attached onto that particular narrative and, you know, what could I do to give back? And so this hit the hero's journey, which is essentially an initiatory journey, as Campbell describes it, felt like sort of quite obscure in society. I couldn't see many examples of it. And I discovered that there are kind of courses and, there was a thing called The Adventure run by a group called The Mankind Project that I heard about basically through a man I really admired. And went at age 40 and kind of asked some very hard questions of myself, allowed myself to be vulnerable in a group of men who were also exploring in the same way. And yeah, really made that descent that Joseph Campbell describes sort of down into like the belly of the whale, where my identity, my role as a you know, who am I, was sort of all stripped away. And I, it was the most powerful thing I'd ever done. So yeah, that, I mean, and I came into coaching quite soon after that. So just realizing the power we can have when that sort of paradigm shift happens.
And I guess there's a marrying there, or there could be a marrying there of the work that you've done as a journalist, where you started to ask those bigger questions, those more existential questions, the hero's journey itself, and the quest that takes us on, and the questions it sort of draws from us. And I often remember about that hero's journey, or about the hero's journey, is as we come out the other side, we then question, so what is this world that we are now coming back to? And as we are different than we were when we entered into the journey, how are we accepted or not accepted by this new world? What's our place in the world now? Which kind of links to then going, right, so let's pick something new up or different up, which then was the coaching.
Yes, absolutely. And I kind of, I came out as a slightly different person. I'm still me, essentially, but very aware of what I've now come to see as shadow. And, you know, this part of myself that I'd been sort of, as Jung puts it, sort of hiding and repressing and denying all my life, as a kind of people pleaser, essentially. I do this, you know, the kind of more primal parts of myself I'd been stuffing down, like we all do, in order to just get on in life. And actually getting back in touch with that shadow, if you like, gave me a huge new source of energy. I just found, I felt so much more alive after that, and in various things that I did subsequently. And so that got me very interested in the shadow. Also because I'd had a very religious upbringing and teenage years. I was very sort of fundamentalist at that stage. And that was all about, you know, darkness versus light, you know, our original sin, that we are essentially, unless we keep a very tight rein on ourselves, we're essentially going to slip down the slippery slope. And this kind of reframed it, actually. Jung's idea of shadow kind of gave me a different way of looking at the difficult stuff that goes on in the world and also inside us. And I much prefer that model now, and that kind of idea, to the idea of sin, as it was put in the Bible and so on.
So let's maybe delve a little bit deeper into the idea of what is shadow in Jung's work. So for those that sort of may have heard of it but don't really have a sense of what it is there a way that you can, I know it's a kind of vast subject, but is there a way that you can maybe condense it into a, you know, this is a bite size of what this work's about?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the genius of the word shadow, as Jung coined it, is that it is a brilliant metaphor. So it's that part that's kind of almost behind us that we don't see. It's the stuff Robert Bly, the poet, kind of described it as sort of a bag into which we stuff all our unwanted traits that aren't met with approval or don't get us what we need. It's sort of not really known to our conscious minds very easily. So actually finding out what your own shadow is quite difficult. It's often other people who can see our shadows much more easily. But there are some great techniques I've discovered for kind of catching a little glimpse of it, which I'll be sharing in the workshop I'm going to be doing. The heart sinks as you kind of catch hold of the shadow. In my experience, you know, I've been looking at myself, my own shadow, in the last few days, and looking at those kind of things that come up consistently as kind of critiques from others, or often the things that drive me nuts about other people. So projection, again, as Jung used it or coined it, is this tendency we have to situate all the things we cannot accept in our own conscious minds about ourselves, to kind of project them onto other people. And so anything which, you know, in my family or in people I know, just drives me absolutely potty, that is almost certainly in me. And because if it wasn't, I wouldn't be so exercised about it. I wouldn't be so emotional. It would just be an observation, which is kind of humiliating, you know, to kind of keep find your own stuff staring back from the mirror.
There's also something quite, I was going to say liberating. I'm not sure if liberating is quite the right word, but something quite exciting to know that when we're around, because it's often people we care about as well, that when the things they do that drive us nuts are in us. But I guess there's also something about the people we choose to care about and choose to have around us. And we can delve into that another time perhaps. But there's something quite exciting about going, ah, oh, when that thing happens and I'm driven nuts about it, what can I look at in myself that is being triggered by that, that I can then address, talk to somebody about, journal, think about, whatever that might be, to allow it its space to exist, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, it's great because you can't really change other people, as we know as coaches, right? We, you know, like somebody comes into our coaching space and we feel like we want to fix them initially. And the genius of shadow work, or working with shadow and projection, taking back projection, is, well, I can't change you, but I can see what you trigger in me and I can work on it in me. So I'm not completely powerless. In fact, it's like all of the things that drive me nuts about you are my own opportunity to grow. And it's kind of, I guess it's sort of obvious how as coaches, this is a really fertile ground, right? Because we're bound to veer into shadow territory, whether it's our own that we're triggered in by in our clients, or we might observe our clients getting completely triggered with somebody else in their lives and be able to ask some gentle questions with them about, you know, what can they own of that themselves? And therefore we can help them to get unstuck too, which I think is such a brilliant subject. I'm really looking forward to being able to kind of work with other coaches on sort of, what can we actually do with this? You know, how can we use it?
And as you say that, as you were talking, my brain was doing this kind of track of going, so what is it that drives me nuts about other people? Oh, okay, there's that to look at. There's this to look at for myself. Oh, okay, there's always stuff. And, you know, that's one of the beauties of life, I guess, is that, you know, it's a constant growing and learning journey. And sometimes we kind of forget that. And it's quite nice to just have it sort of reflected back at us to remember, hey, there's something you can work on and chip away at. And also without that sense of perfectionism of, we're going to get somewhere, because it's like, this is a forever journey.
Yeah, I mean, actually, I'm just back, like literally about 2 hours ago, from a little road trip with my teenage son, who's 16. And you know how teenagers are, they're kind of guaranteed to press your button. We're sharing a hotel room, and I'm noticing the kind of clothes on the floor and they're kind of constantly on the phone and the sort of the general can't be arsedness about being a teenager. And I've come across this before. I've been working on this for a couple of years, actually. There's something about the phrase "I can't be arsed" which drives me so nuts that I know there's something in it for me. And I think it's that I grew up the opposite of that. As such a people pleaser, give me a hoop, I'll jump through it. What do you need me to be? What do you need me to do? I'm just I'm there to oblige you. And there's a part of me obviously that aches to be able to just to let go and to just say, do you know what? I can't be bothered. And it's a kind of, it's a projection of this deep part of myself onto my son. And when I realized that, actually I had quite a good time. I could, a couple of times I got triggered and I was able to say, sorry, that is actually not my business. But I'd really like the hotel room to be a bit kind of tidier, if that's okay. But I'm going to go downstairs and cool off because I don't think that's about you. And just to be able to, work with that in the moment in our relationships can be really useful. And I know a lot of clients have found that kind of quite revolutionary. There's tools that aren't actually flagged as shadow tools. But for example, the work of Byron Katie, I don't know if you come across where you flip a judgment on a neighbor and you flip it and imagine, could that be equally true of me? Or you put yourself in the frame. That's really a tool for taking back projections, as far as I can see. And it works really well for me. I use that a lot in my own life, but also with clients as a kind of, what's this belief that's causing you pain? And how can we reconfigure it?
Yeah, I really like that sort of flipping it around or almost reframing it, instead of it being an external, but looking at what's the internal here? Where am I in this picture? Where am I in this work? And I guess, or I imagine that when working with a thinking partner, a client, a coachee, whatever phrase we'd like to kind of coin the person that sits with us when we're in coaching. I'm imagining that there's a little bit of education that's needed around this is the work that we're doing for somebody to be able to almost take on that noticing as an exercise.
Yeah. And I mean, the biggest thing that comes up for most people in my experience is, yes, but my son is untidy. Yes, but my son is lazy. I need to him to acknowledge it. I need that to be acknowledged. And I don't think it's that Jung was saying the thing you see in another person isn't there. It's that if you're that emotional about it, if you're that triggered by it, it's also in you. Mm. So, I mean, interestingly, if I go right back to my religious phase, there's a, you know, Jesus said, interestingly, about the speck and the planks. He says, you hypocrites, first take the plank out of your own eye, and then you'll see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. That's about taking back projections. I mean, that's like, it was, you know, that for me, that was such a revelation to think this thing that I'd read and heard for years was essentially about, we notice, well, if you spot it, you got it. We've got all these kind of phrases, haven't we? It takes one to know one. I mean, that's about projection. The pot calling the kettle black is another, you know, saying that we've got. And it's everywhere. Once you start to notice it, you notice
it. I was going to say, it's. I always love those moments where you begin to notice something and then you go, wait, this is part of our language. This is part of our existence. We just don't name it as shadow or shadow work, but it's part of our everyday existence. We can recognize that when we get wound up about something that we often go, what is it about that person that triggers me so? What's there that's causing that? Maybe we wouldn't use the word trigger because I think that's a very coachy kind of word. But
it's almost universal in schools now. So I mean, my son's always using it. I think that generation triggered is a thing. You know, they just I don't know if they use it quite in a psychological sense, but yeah, it seems to be almost universally used in my experience now.
Yeah,
and that is kind of, I mean, often it's used like you triggered me, as if, oh, it's your fault that I feel this way, and that's not what triggering is, you know.
I guess there's something in you saying that you know we're talking about shadow here, that there's something in going, you triggered me, and externalizing it that's trying to keep it away from the self.
Yeah,
because otherwise we have to look at the self and go, what is it about me that is energized or heightened by this?
Yeah. And I mean, obviously there's a whole realm of trauma here that I also don't want to make light of, because, you know, people say trigger warning for good reason, because it is quite hard not to, for the hooks of that trigger to get into you if you've had particular experiences. But even there, like, you know, working with the shadow, if you've had a traumatic experience, I think can be incredibly powerful with the right practitioner, you know, to be able to liberate you from the sense of being at the mercy of someone else, to kind of own your own reaction. I mean, there's loads in it. Obviously, I'm just doing a one-day masterclass at this stage, trying to sort of get a sort of sense of it and throw out a few tools. But you could spend, you know, a year course on this stuff.
Yeah, I was about to say, you could spend a lifetime exploring this work.
Indeed, yeah.
Because there was something you said there about, you know, not wanting, this may not have been your exact language, but not wanting to make light of trauma. And it made me wonder, you know, as a coach, when doing this work, how do you manage that sense or possible reality that trauma and shadow work can coexist, and therefore, as a coach who isn't necessarily trained to work with trauma, that can come into the space?
Yeah, good. It's a great question. I mean, you do it very carefully with the answer, and be prepared to notice, this looks like there may be trauma here. I'm not trauma trained. And therefore we work very consciously around that. I mean, I probably wouldn't work in a coaching space with shadow work if I knew that somebody was traumatized. But having said that, I've worked in men's circles a lot with processes, quite sort of bodily processes of people getting triggered, or, you know, that people getting sort of into conflict. And when it's held well, and there's a process to do it, I've seen amazing breakthroughs for people from their own personal trauma when there's a kind of safe container. I'm a massive believer in safe containers, and I won't be doing anything on a one-day masterclass which unleashes anything that, you know, puts that at risk. But I hope I will be giving enough kind of clues and sort of usable, in fact, sort of solo exercises, even, you know, stuff that you can take away or give to your client. Say, you know, try this, you know, try Byron Katie's The Work when you're feeling really like there's something there. That'll help you just to, and you're in control. You can say, could this be as true or truer? And if it isn't, chuck it out. But if it is, then, you know, you've got that amazing opportunity to change and to accept a new truth about yourself.
And I think I really like that sense of, you know, as a coach, you're working carefully and you're paying attention to what's in the space. And, you know, I remember talking with Julia Vaughan Smith a while back and her saying, you know, we all have trauma. Yeah. And because when I first sort of begun to explore coaching, I had this sense that there were the traumatized and the non-traumatized. And as coaches, we work with the non-traumatized. And over time was like, wait a minute, but we all seem to have trauma. And then Julie was kind of affirming that fact. But it's about, you know, how heightened is our trauma? How close to the surface is it? And how are we able to manage or manage doesn't feel like quite the right phrase here, but how we, you know, how do we contain what sits within us and where is our agency and our ability with that? And so there is something here about as coaches to ask questions around this, to explore this work or the possibility of trauma or trigger with clients so that we have a sense of what's at play here. And to, when we notice things bubbling up, to have that conversation in that contained space so we're not surprised by it, but we're also not afraid to explore it.
Yeah, I mean, just remembering that our clients, you know, are creative, resourceful and whole rather than broken. Often there's this tendency to think, oh, heavy trauma, that my client's somehow not functioning or broken. Yeah. Actually, just that spectrum idea is so much more helpful. But also, I think, you know, I want to acknowledge, like my wife, for example, is a person-centered counselor of 18 years experience, and I want to acknowledge that she's going to have much more capability around that. And as a coach, that isn't part of my coach training, so I don't want to kind of take the risk of going particularly where abuse and so on is involved. I want to be very respectful and make sure the container's safe.
And I think that, you know, often when I sort of have these kinds of conversations where we start to talk about trauma, I'm always concerned not to frighten coaches off, especially new coaches who then go, well, I don't want to get near trauma, I'm going to run away. But also to remind people to not be gung-ho about this stuff and to be sensitive and to be aware and to notice. And I guess also what fits into this is, you know, have supervision, but also check out what's going on for you in all of this, because it's a relationship and we are part of that. So what is happening in the relationship, not just outside with the person that we're working with.
Oh, totally. And that's almost half the gift, I'd say, of this workshop, is that it's our opportunity to look at our stuff as coaches, because we can't really help our clients any further than we've taken our own sort of exploration. And, you know, that client that, you know, really winds you up, and it's frustrating because they just won't change, or there's a real opportunity there. You go, okay, that's it. I mean, not in the space usually, but you can take it away with you and go, what is it about that client that is giving me an opportunity to look at something in me? And suddenly you've got an amazing, and you could be in supervision, as you say, or it could be on your own, sort of in a doing a process. But I just think it's an amazing tool for personal growth. And it was one of the biggest shifts in me, the sort of this discovery of projection. It was in a process I did in a men's circle where somebody was allowed to, you know, if say I was really annoyed with you, Robert, I don't know, for you're always late for podcasts, not that you are, but you know, and there would be an opportunity in a held space for me to say to you, All of those. Well, first of all, the data, the kind of the basic facts is that, you know, I observed you were 7 minutes late if you had been, and then what feelings does that bring up, and then what judgments does that bring up, and even in having to classify them as feelings, judgment, and facts, I'm starting to notice that there's the basic ground of the 7 minutes, then there's what I do with that, what the story is that I tell about it, what the emotions are that come up. And I can give you all of that whilst acknowledging this isn't your work. So the way it's set up, or was set up in this group, is that this isn't about you, Rob. It's about me working with my stuff, we'll call it, and having a chance to take back my projection onto you and look at where in my own life am I not showing up on time, either literally or metaphorically. And I've had some brilliant moments with other men, just when something will dawn on me, or something will dawn on them if I'm the person receiving their judgment. And you start to realize that, you know, so much of what causes us pain is actually our story about other people that we can choose to take back. So yeah, as you can tell, I'm very excited about shadow work and projection in general. I don't know if any of it makes any sense. But.
Well, it does. And what's interesting is it sort of pings me into lots of different areas. So the one thought was about some of the work that we've done with young people at Animus. So myself and Nick Bolton, the CEO and founder of Animus, we co-created a youth coaching program. And one of the models that we had, or an extension of sort of the Wheel of Life, was the 3S, which stood for feeling, fact, and future. And we were in discussion about, you know, when you're working with a young person, they're calling their emotion. So when I've worked with young people that have often been labeled as challenging, I might label them as gifted, but that young person in the space that kind of is given those sorts of labels, they're so caught up in their emotion about what's happening, what's going on for them, that unless you let those emotions out, you can't get onto, so what are you going to do about it? Yeah. Because they need to express what's going on for them. So we sort of went, you know, well, let's let somebody express their emotion. And then once that's done, then we can go, so what's the facts here? So we know how you feel, but what can we notice as perhaps you might describe as universal truths about that situation, or the data? And now we know that, now we have expressed how we feel and we understand that data, what do we want to do next with it? Where do we want this to go to? And there was something when you were talking, I was like, oh, that's really interesting, because I'd never thought of it in a shadow or projection ownership kind of way. But in this, I was like, oh, wait a minute. I wonder if there was more going on when we were creating that than we were kind of aware of.
Great. Yeah, that sounds right on the money, actually. I mean, and actually having practical models that will work with, you know, young people even is just so important, because this idea, I mean, what's really interesting is that part of the problem is that as youngsters, as kids, we're told that expressing our emotions is not okay. So that's part of this split that happens. Gabor Mate, who's brilliant on all of this stuff, said, in a podcast I was listening to the other day, that as kids, we've got two core needs for attachment, which is about survival. Because if you're not attached properly to your caregivers, then you're doomed, essentially. But also authenticity, and, you know, which is how you feel any given moment. And if as a little kid, you kind of have a tantrum and you're told, we don't get angry in this house, Robert, you know, and you then stuff it down, that is the first bit of stuff going into the shadow bag, the big bag of the shadow. And Robert Bly says, like, we spend our lives until we're 20 deciding what parts of ourselves to stuff in this bag, and then we spend the rest of our lives trying to get them out again, because it's gold. You know, a lot of it that we've stuffed down is energetic gold, like the anger, when it's allowed to be expressed in a safe place, in a safe way, can bring huge change energy, in my experience.
But yeah, because we're not saying, you know, anger as in being angry and going around and smashing up the place. We're talking about what does that anger represent, and what can we do with it as an energy to create change, but also as a I guess there's a power, because I know, so, you know, there's something going on and I get angry about it. There's an energy to make change and do something about it that's fired up and brought about. Whereas if I repress that, it kind of holds you back from creating change and doing something. And I sometimes notice when working with people that are stuck, when they get angry about being stuck and what may have caused that stuckness, they start to shift and they start to change. And I guess that's also linked into some kind of somatic working somewhere. Mm-hmm. You know, how do we use the body or tap into what's happening in the body as information and tools for change?
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I mean, that kind of moment of being allowed to go and sort of let it out in a bodily way can be so liberating for that sort of gray stuckness that so many of us come to, particularly in midlife, where we've really ground to a halt with all of the things we're not allowing ourselves to be or think or express. And then to allow some of it out in a kind of controlled way, perhaps, or just go out in the middle of nowhere and just yell or whatever, can be so energizing. I was thinking of the Philip Pullman trilogy, or now it's, I think there's like six of them, but his world in which all of us have sort of animal demons, as he calls them, that are kind of our soul, you know. It was serialized on the BBC not long ago, but that instinctively feels, yes, exactly right. It's like he's writing about the shadow in some way, this part that in kids changes, shapeshifts from, you know, a puma to a ferret to a bird or whatever. And then by a certain age, within his kind of world, you know, adults kind of basically either kind of put a lid on it so that the animal sort of stays the same, or, you know, worst case scenario, kind of cut off connection with that sort of primal part of ourselves at great cost. And shadow work for me feels like, in a beautiful way, to kind of regain contact almost with that sort of inner animal part of us that gives us so much energy. You know, and if it's befriended, then I don't know, I've seen some amazing lives changed in that way. I'm getting so excited here, Robert. I'm sorry. Calm myself down. Stuff it back in the bag. Yeah.
No, let it out the bag. Let it out the bag. It's really interesting. I was talking to Simon Kavicki the other day. He was part of the month of diversity, equity, and inclusion conversations that we were having. And I was saying that, you know, I'm so excited about this. I need to contain myself. And he's like, oh, no, you don't. That's not what we do. Yeah. Let it out, because that's part of, you know, why we're here. And if we, it's really interesting, because when we hide that part of ourselves, we're inauthentic in ourselves, and that then shows up in lots of other areas. And, you know, in that sense that the animal becomes stuck in that shape and is no longer fluid and changeable, we become stuck in our shapes.
Yeah,
and I think, you know, that also sort of resonates with this idea of, for some, that's that point of going to coaching, is where we've become stuck and we go, I don't know what I want to do. And I've lost that fluidity, that playfulness, that all of that stuff about me's gone. But also, I've played the game of what I think I should be for so long that I've lost who I am in this. And I recognize who I'm being isn't who I am, but I can't find who I am.
Yeah, yeah, and I love that Jung said of the shadow that 90% of it is pure gold. So it's not, I mean, there is dark stuff in our shadow bags that's like there for good reason, you know, but I guess we kind of put stuff away because we have to work as a civilized society. And, you know, societies put sort of prohibit certain things that are kind of could be called shadow. But a lot of it, when it's particularly when it's reclaimed, is beautiful traits that would just only add to our personalities and our enjoyment of life. And actually, as they're integrated and as they're brought into the light, they become positive things. Because you can also project good qualities as well. So if you hero worship somebody, or if you think, if only I was like Robert, you know, or if only I was like Madonna or whatever it is, you are also putting something of yourself that is there out onto someone else. And you can equally take back the projection of that. So that's a sort of golden projection, which I love, you know, sort of that part that a client might sort of attribute to, if only I could do that, then to sort of help them to find that in their own life is really lovely. But I think mostly integrating a shadow tends to be a midlife thing that some of us come to kicking and screaming just because we've ground to a halt. I know that was my experience for sure. It's a bit of just being stuck and needing to let go and find a different way.
So I'm imagining there are people watching or listening to us here, and for those of that have kind of hung on to this conversation, because there are parts of this where I kind of recognize both of us getting excited and traveling in different directions. And there might be people sort of going, okay, so I noticed this in myself. So what do I do with this stuff? It's great becoming aware of it. And we talk about it being golden and energizing. But if we're not seeing that goldenness to it or that energy to it, if we're still caught in the paradigm where this is my bad stuff, but they kind of begin to recognize it or notice it, what might somebody, as a gentle first step, begin to do with this if you've got a tool or an offering here?
Yeah, I mean, well, I think the most powerful thing I've experienced to do with it is to do parts work of some kind, which is, you know, that kind of acknowledging that we have different sub-personalities or sub-parts, and we can start to gently befriend the ones that are most marginalized. So the most shadowy parts of ourselves are the ones we know least, actually, might never have allowed ourselves to address. And so, for example, you might use Gestalt empty chair work, where you know, the part of you that wants to fight, say, you might spend the day talking to that person to fight. Well, you know, what do you want? What is it you want to fight? Tell me more about, you know, what's going on. In that kind of facilitated way that as coaches we often learn, you know, which is a sort of physical getting up out of a chair and sitting in another chair and embodying the part of you that is closer to shadow. That would be one example that I find particularly powerful. As I say, you can do that in written form using the work of Byron Katie. You can do it in a kind of corporate setting, which is where I first conceived this workshop. I find the Johari window is quite interesting. This idea of the kind of the blind self, it's essentially the shadow, the bit that we don't know, the unknown self that even other people don't know about us. But often people do spot the stuff that we can't see. And it's not called the shadow in the Johari window. It's called the blind self, that unknown to self, but known to others. And so asking people what they see can be quite a bracing way of starting to unearth your shadow. And there are kind of questionnaires you can give out in a kind of team setting, saying, you know, could you of all of these adjectives, could you tell me the ones both positive and negative that you would associate with me? And often some of the positives and the negatives might be a surprise. But if you find like three different people are starting to say the same thing, then the likelihood is this is something you don't really know much about in yourself, but which is probably there. So again, you know, that's one way of starting to work with it. I think the other question is, supposing you have this big list of shadow qualities in yourself you didn't know about, it's kind of heavy, isn't it? It's like to know that, you know, actually there's a bit of me that is... you sort of can't be asked, to use my own example, you know, what do I do with that? Do I want that? Do I want to acknowledge that? Is that true? Do I just need to fix it and suddenly become motivated again? Or is there a kind of integrated way where I can say, actually, Nick, you go at things like a bull at a gate. How about, you know, taking some pauses? Maybe the kind of that is a kind of urgent need for you to stop. And so, for example, I did a whole year when I was a travel writer, I was just traveling around talking to people who'd let go in some way and trying to learn from them, because I was so I was so into this personality that worked hard that I pretty much drove myself to burnout. And so that was again one of those midlife moments of, okay, this isn't working. What have I stuffed away which might be of use to me? And what it was I don't want to do anything for a while. I just want to let go and learn how to do that bit. So it's hard. I don't think I've just been reading a kind of lovely book of edited essays about the shadow, and everybody admits it's both humiliating and liberating to sit with your shadow, just to sit there and look at the full spectrum of the fuller spectrum of who we are, good, dark, you know, the things we wish weren't true about us, but which consistently are. Yeah. Just to sit in it. I don't know. How do you do it, Robert? It's like a, this stage in life, you know, how do we sit with the dark stuff?
I think we talk to people. The way that I do it is I have people around me that I'm able to discuss this stuff with, that who can hold a space or reflect back or remind me. Mm. I think it's really important, you know, when you go through challenging or difficult times to have people around you. I mean, it's one of the reasons I'm so passionate about coaching, because I go, you know, when stuff's going on, there's somebody you can turn to and go, this is what's going on. And they don't befriend you in that, what's going on. They sit objectively, but empathically with you to explore what that is and what that means for you, and allow you to look at that. And I think some of the practitioners that I work with, you know, they're a very wide range of practitioners. So some of them are very spiritual in the way that they work, and some of them are very factual in the way that they work. And I sort of work with this spectrum of people, because I think it's important for me to look at that spectrum and not to get, I have a tendency to get stuck somewhere, to get fixated about something. I go, oh, it's that. There's the thing I found, and that's the answer to everything. And I plant it in the sand. And I go, right, that's it. And I've noticed that about myself over time. So now I go, right, I can have an idea of what is, but then let me step back and work with a spectrum of people to see what else is out there and what else is possible.
Yeah. A sort of bigger picture and a slightly kinder picture often. It feels like you need a mixture of people are willing to challenge you, but also compassionate friends as well, who can say, you know, yeah, that you, there is a bit of that, but Nick, but you know, this is also this, and you know, let's look at the whole spectrum, as you say.
Yeah, because I think sometimes, as you said, you know, when you sit with this stuff, it can be heavy, especially when you are new to sitting with this work, and if there is no compassion. Mm-hmm. It can create other things. So you know, you can just get hateful of the self because you're looking at that those shadow sides of self, or the sides that you don't like. So you begin to hate yourself or that side of yourself, as opposed to embracing that compassionately and holding with tenderness and kindness, and go, okay, so what can I learn from you? How can I bring you into my life and hold you as part of this? I remember years ago, I think I was doing NLP training, where they talked about it as the parts of you that you've left in the cupboard, and how might you open the cupboard from time to time and engage with them and be able to leave the door open more and more and more and more until it's a free space for them to come in and out.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I find that really interesting, especially when I go, oh wait, I've closed the cupboard.
When there's loads of stuff in it, you think, oh, let's just shut the door. But there's something nice about not having to look at it all at once, but knowing it's there. I got a bit overwhelmed a couple of days ago when I was sort of looking at this material and also looking at my own shadow. And just thought, what do I do with this? It's just been there all my life. I see it now. And in the end, I was meditating, and I just kind of imagined like putting the whole bundle of it in front of that kind of inner animal, you know, like a panther or something, and just, could you look after it for me? And there's something kind of unspoken and wordless about, you know, the gaze of an animal. And for me, that was like, okay, that gives me a bit of a breather. And it also reminds me of that kind of Carl Rogers, lovely kind of unconditional positive regard feel. What is that? My favorite quote by him. So the curious paradox is that when I accept myself just as I am, then I can change.
Yes.
It's like, yes. Weird, but true.
Yeah, because there's got to be acceptance, right? Because that denying of self means that you're not actually looking at the full spectrum of self.
Yeah, yeah. and it's all there. And I do think it's kind of a second half of life thing often. Often a lot of my clients, I seem to get sort of midlife people who are transitioning and really their shadow's right in their face, you know, either because they've sought it or because somebody's presented it to them. And it's a big process. I feel a lot of compassion for anybody who's sitting looking at that cupboard or that big pile of opening the bag even to look and see what's at the top, you know.
Yeah,
it's hard.
So I sort of get a sense that the work you do and the masterclass that you're doing for Animus, and that there is a lot of discussion and debate and exploration to kind of get a sense of this work, yeah, and some tools that we can take away and explore. And I imagine over time that this will build into something bigger that people can spend time and sit with. And it just makes me think about sort of what are the other things that you're sort of doing now? What else is on your radar or on the horizon for you in terms of either projects, be that new writing, new workshops, or whatever that might be? I'm just curious about that.
Yeah, thank you. It's a slightly kind of uncomfortable question, actually, because in some ways I feel like I've been very inward facing for, you know, probably about a decade, actually, having been very outward facing and public and published and, journalistic for like 20 years before that. So I've been kind of licking my wounds a bit and working a lot with my own shadow, I think, and sort of that downward journey that Joseph Campbell talks about. Mm. And I'm just starting to feel that I've got some really big changes happening in my personal life, and things are starting to shift and to move. And one of the real callings I feel is around kind of initiating young men into a kind of an adulthood which they currently don't really get led into very easily. And so I'm involved with an organization called Journeyman, which specifically, you know, works with kind of groups of young men. And, you know, my son's getting a little bit involved with that, which is great. It just gives an emotional literacy to boys who are still being told, really, that actually boys don't talk about their feelings, even despite all of the work that's been done. So I'm quite passionate about that, and I feel that's going to become a little bit more outward facing, and I'll be stepping into that a bit more. And my writing remains a mystery. I mean, I kind of, you know, I was defined as somebody who wrote for most of my life, and I've never not written, but I've written in a journal, sort of just journaling for myself mostly for like the last 10 years. And there's a curiosity in me about, well, will, you know, was that my public phase back then, or will I, is it time to write some more? I actually don't know. It's like, I don't want to assume anything, actually, because I've kind of gone past the stage where I can force myself to do stuff that I think I ought to be doing. I seem to want to see what rises up in me and follow that, you know, follow the flow. And I'm aware that sounds uncomfortably flaky, but it's the truth.
I don't know if it sounds flaky. It sounds very honest, and it sounds very present to what is. And I think there's something very courageous about being present to what is, even if that what is an unknowing.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the unknown, I think, is a very juicy place, actually. I quite like the idea of, as long as I like myself, essentially, walking into the unknown is adventure. Mm. And that could be what I used to do, which is like go on big read boat voyages and stuff. Or it could be, hey, Nick, I have no idea whether I'm going to write another book or what my work will look like in 5 years, but I'm just following my gut and working with my shadow and seeing what comes up.
Yeah. That sounds beautiful. And I hope that in the next 5 years we can sit and have another conversation and see where that journey has led.
Yeah, I'd like that. Yeah, I'm curious myself. Who knows? But I mean, we're all in the same journey in a way, aren't we? We're all just trying to work out what to do next, why we're here. I think that's what I love about coaching. It's like a license to talk about this stuff with people all day, every day.
Yeah, for sure. So, Nick, as always, it's an absolute pleasure speaking with you. And, you know, we could talk into the wee hours of the night around this and other subjects. And, you know, if for people that are watching or listening that would like to find out more about you and your work, is there a space or a place where they could go to do that?
Yeah, the easiest place is my website, probably, which is nickthorpe.co.uk, www.nickthorpe, nickthorpe.co.uk. Yeah, that's the best place. And also the details of any workshops that I'm leading on the Animas CPD section of the Animas website.
Awesome. Brilliant. Nick, as I said, it's been an absolute pleasure. I, as we sit and talk about this, I'm like, I think I might need to sign up to do the course, because I'm like, I want to explore this stuff too. And there's something that's been awoken in me to kind of delve into this a bit more. So thank you so much for that.
Lovely. Hope to see you there, Robert. Great.
Cheers. Take care. Bye, Nick.
If you'd like to watch these episodes as well as listen, you can find the video interviews on our YouTube channel and website now. Thanks for tuning in to Coaching Uncaged. Join us again for more captivating conversations, exploring the art of coaching.